All right, everyone, I think we're going to get started. First, I want to say thank you. I see we've got some vets here in the crowd. I want to say, first of all, thank you to all of you for your service, including Tom, who we have here today. He's going to talk a bit about his book, The Most Fun I Ever Had With My Clothes On. It's a memoir about his time in the military, including in the Special Forces. So everyone, please welcome Tom Davis to City Lights Bookstore.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. And before I forget it, Ron Rash will be here tomorrow at 1 o'clock, right?
Yes.
So that'd be something else to do on a Sunday afternoon after lunch at church. So, also, I've got a couple of other books other than that one. This is an action-adventure novel that they have, and that's a collection of short stories. This is not for the squeamish reader. That's a warning here. I started writing my memoir. I had the beginning of the memoir in my head for many years, and I had the ending in my head after I retired. I knew exactly how I wanted to start it and how I wanted to end it. My wife, Polly, who's going to be reading, we're going to do a little he said, she said, started taking a course in memoir writing offered by Brian Connaught through the University of North Carolina in Asheville through their, what's the writing program? The
Great
Smoky. Great Smoky, that's right. Anyway, Polly would come back and talk about this great, wonderful professor and how she was so all excited and telling them how to do this and how to do that. And I said, well, okay, I'll write a memoir. She's still working on hers, and mine's into its second printing and soon to go into the third. But while I did mine quickly, and I think it's pretty good, but hers is going to be great, and I'm hopefully looking forward to next year, hers being out. We would be sitting in our little computer room side by side, and she'd be writing on hers, and I'm writing on mine, and we're going, and then she'd say something, and I'd look over there, and I'd read some of them, and I'd say, what are you talking about? That isn't the way it happened. And then I'd read her mind, and she'd say, no, you got it all wrong. This is what. So it's like Venus and Mars. So
it's always.
And I got to thinking, wouldn't it be, and she was going to read at Malaprops, her prologue, which was dubbed as worthy of being read at Malaprop. And Polly mentioned to the Malaprops people that, well, Tom's writing his too, and I said, well, why don't you guys come both read a little bit? And then I got thinking, well, he said, she said. And it turned out pretty good. So we're going to do that for you to start with, and then I'll read a couple of excerpts from my book. And then we can have some questions, and if anybody wants to buy a book and wants me to sign it, I'd be happy to do that. It'll take probably like 22, 23 minutes for our little he said, she said, which is kind of long, but it's pretty entertaining. So, if I do say so myself.
Really not fair, you know, I started this whole thing. Thanks to Brian. And so Tom decided that he would write his, and by golly, he's been through this for a year, and I'm still muddling along. But it's getting there, and it's moving faster and faster. My roommate from South Georgia fixed me up with Tom. I was sure we were a perfect match, both Baptists, both blonde and blue-eyed, both Roy Oyster crazy, and our people were from South Georgia. In my naivete, he met all the criteria. We ended up traipsing the world together, often at odds, gradually realizing the path we followed could easily spell disaster for a marriage. Vietnam loomed, but students at the University of Georgia were too absorbed in sorority and frat houses, keg parties, and rush to be concerned with a war in that tiny little country. We lived in a vacuum, a microcosm of polite society. Libraries and naive kids. Recruiters would surely not invade a southern college campus like the University of Georgia. Graduation was approaching, and the family friend running the draft board in Vienna, Georgia, Tom's hometown, called to alert him that his name was coming up. The call to his dad, whom he thought would pull some strings, was to no avail. "I'd hate to see you go to war, son, but be a good patriot."
"Dad, I got a call from Miss Burke," I sat holding the phone with a white knuckle fist. "Yeah? Well, she said, you know, looks like my name's up." I glanced around my apartment in Athens, Georgia, an overstuffed and stained sofa sat against the far wall, framed by two wooden end tables, each topped with lamps supported large umbrella-shaped shades. I found myself on probationary summer quarter of the law school at the University of Georgia. I hoped against hope that I would do well enough to get accepted as a regular student in the upcoming fall. Dad's friend nicknamed him Lightning when he was growing up because of his very slow draw. Now he drew out a question to the point that made me want to scream. "What do you think you'll do about it?" This wasn't the way I envisioned the conversation going. No way. He was a prominent South Georgia lawyer. My grandfather was a federal court judge for the Middle District of Georgia. Both had connections up the political chain all the way to Sam Nunn, senator from the great state of Georgia and chairman of the Armed Services Committee. For God's sake. I expected him to say something like, "Give me a couple of days to look into this, then things would be okay, and I would be exempt from the big green army machine." "Well, I don't know. It looks like I might, you know, have to go in. And of course I'll be in Vietnam before long." "Uh-huh," came a distant reply. In the summer of 1968, things weren't looking very good over there. During that year's Tet Offensive, we lost over 500 Americans, with some 2,500 more wounded in just 7 days. All together that year, we would lose over 15,500 souls. The fact that the enemy was well on its way to losing 200,000 didn't do much for the hopes that I would make it back in one piece, if at all. I continued. "Well, I looked into the National Guard, but the recruiter told me that they were full up. Maybe in a month or two, an opening would come up, and, you know, I might be able to get in. But I don't have a few months." "Okay, for sure." Now I expected him to say, "Let me give Sam a call and see what he says." But no. "Looks like you don't have much choice then," Dad said instead. I decided to give him one more chance to pull my fat out of the fire as he'd always done in the past. What do you think I should do, you know, about this?" "I think you should be real careful and write home often." Well, hell.
We were married after basic training and I was at candidate school. I stood clueless at the altar. The only soldiers I'd known were in the comics. The profession was one I didn't hold in high regard, and marrying one seemed surreal. I first tour at Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, focused on preparation for the war, fighting the fear that filled our throats when TV newscasters flashed body bags in rising numbers. We were forced to pretend life was normal. Finding a place to live until we moved on to post foreshadowed the rest of our life in the Army. Tom had heard of some apartments that were really cheap. He always went for cheap. His decision was made. Convincing me was easy. His income as a second lieutenant was meager. I had no job, no income, and applying for a job teaching was pointless. Public school had already begun.
In August of 1969, Polly and I pulled into the driveway of our newly rented house just off Murkison Road, a.k.a. the Murk. A friend who graduated with me from OCS, Dewey Newman, arrived a month before we did and found the place. After we moved in, Polly found out that this was not the place to live. Hey, it had a bed, an indoor toilet, a refrigerator, and a stove. What more do we need, right? And when you open the cabinet doors under the sink, you didn't see the ground. That story is saved for later in the book.
Once Tom was drunk qualified, parachuting became for him an immediate passion, ebbing only as his jumps multiplied. He joined the 82nd Sports Parachute Club, and we routinely spent weekends at the drop zone. I was the good wife. We grudgingly prepared the picnic lunch and sat around with other wives waiting for our men to jump, cheering them on and waiting, waiting, waiting till the jumps were over. And then we would continue on to the club for beers and war stories with the guys. This grew old. Since I believed in those days that husbands and wives should do everything together, I decided to join them. After investigating, I found that yes, spouses and civilians, anybody for that matter, could take skydiving lessons on post. I joined the club. For 4 weeks, I drove on to post in the evenings for jump classes, wondering to myself exactly what I was trying to prove. We met the instructor in the rigger shed. His dark ponytail, held back by a rubber band, was the only thing distinguishing him from the male students. A civilian master sports parachutist, over 6 feet, with a strong profile and straight teeth, he smiled often and treated us equally, although he was slightly taken aback to find a woman in his class. I breathed a sigh of relief that he treated me no differently than the men. We learned to pack our own parachutes, the ones we would be jumping with, and to understand the elements and nuances of jumping out of a plane. We also learned how to make a safe parachute landing fall, rolling in a sawdust pile for the better part of each evening. The day arrived when I was qualified to make my first static line jump. The 40 pounds of olive drab gear cinched tightly to my back hobbled my movement. It was difficult to breathe, and the protective helmet impaired my vision. Did I still want to do this? The instructor continued to encourage me as we boarded the small Cessna 170 together. When the pilot cut the motor, I was frozen between nausea and fear of blacking out. The motor purred quietly, but wind whipped in the open door. I was instructed, reach out and grab the strut with both hands, stabilize yourself, then let go. So I reached out the door, mind numb, fist in my chest. I was able to clutch the strut, but the thundering gust outside the plane quickly blew me into a split second of chaos, a terrible spinning and sputtering, and then I heard it, a smooth popping sound, a snap, a rough jerk, and my chute floated open above me. I was alive and all was calm. No sound, no sense of movement, aquamarine heavens, billowing rows of green below me, I floated, savoring the absolute ecstasy of the moment. Suddenly, voices below were shouting, use your toggle lines. Too late. I was slowly drifting into a grove of pine trees. Remembering the instructions to streamline my body if this happened, I slipped down between branches and was caught just a few feet off the ground. Rapidly jogging toward me, a young soldier was muttering loudly, a woman just ought to stay home. She just ought to stay home where she belongs. The next jump fared better. Out the door spinning, but keeping my wits about me, I pulled the toggle lines to guide my open chute toward the waiting crowd. Dumb luck or determination propelled me to a landing 15 feet from the center. Cheers all around. My decision was not difficult to make. Yep, I'm quitting while I'm ahead. Tom admitted, I haven't had a good night's sleep since you started this. Years passed and we knew many a paratrooper who lost his life. Today I believe it's suicidal for people to jump out of planes for sport, especially those with families depending on it.
As any gung-ho, brand new, spanking second lieutenant assigned to an airborne unit, I would join the 82nd Sports Parachute Club. When I wasn't in the field pulling duty officer, I'd drag Polly out to Rafer drop zone so she could watch me be the man. Of course, she had to sit around for 2 hours or so just to watch me bask in my 10 minutes of fame. She soon got bored with the whole thing, and while I was out doing my Army thing at night during the week, she signed up for classes with the parachute club and announced that now I could go to the DZ with her and watch her jump out of airplanes. Well, hell. On Polly's very first jump, she went straight for a grove of pine trees and proceeded to destroy several as she tumbled ass over a tea kettle through them. I concluded that it was a hell of a lot easier jumping out of a plane than watching someone you love do it. My fun meter was not registering so high. I suggested that she hang it up and just be happy watching me be the man. That didn't go over too well either. And the next Saturday, she was right back out there defying death and turning me into a nervous wreck. As it happened, on a second jump, she managed to land near the pit. Hey, even a blind hog can find an acorn now and again. Much to my pleasure, she declared that she had mastered the art of parachuting and was going to give it up. Did I mind? Not at all.
Vietnam loomed like a forest fire edging past the break. Tom went to war, and I went to graduate school. No longer the crazy co-ed, I saw Athens as a place for young men who piled degrees upon degrees to stay in college. I'd catch myself avoiding windows, look out for those gray cars that pulled up in front of homes, shadowy figures forcing their feet to move to doorways with that awful message, Tom and I were lucky. Tom suggested that I take a scuba class while in Athens so we could dive together on our next tour. The week he returned from Vietnam, I graduated with my master's and flunked the scuba class the same day. Humiliating. Completing finals and learning those abominable decompression tables simultaneously had been hopeless. Later, when we moved to Fort Devens, 20 minutes from Concord, Massachusetts, Tom and I tackled another scuba class together. We passed without a hitch and completed our checkout dive in Walden Pond. That, for an English major, was pure serendipity.
To start with, Polly and I took a civilian scuba course taught by one of my special forces buddies and great scuba instructor, Tom Long. The course ended with a checkout dive in Walden Pond, a small, dirty little pond near Fort Devens. I wasn't impressed, but Polly, being an English major, was, for some reason, thrilled with the fact, and still is, no figure.
And then there was the move from Fort Devens to Fort Benning.
About 2 weeks before Polly and I were to pack up and leave for Fort Devens, Major Kearney called me into his office. The company had been tasked by SWIC, the Special Forces School at Fort Bragg, through the group headquarters to conduct a test of the Viking dry suits in cold weather for a new surface swimming infiltration course that they were about to bring online. The month was February, and the test would be conducted in Groton, Connecticut. It would involve swimming long distances out in the ocean and in the river, as well as a parachute jump off the coast. It would also mean we would be on TDY, temporary duty, and draw an extra $22 a day. Major Kearney knew I was about to leave and was asked if I wanted to conduct this one last hurrah. What was I to do? I drove home and charged into the front door. Polly stood surveying the room, thinking how she would plan the upcoming move. At the time, she was 1 month pregnant with our daughter, Pollyanna, but we didn't know it. "You're not going to believe this," I said, trying my best to look frustrated, but not quite pulling it off. Polly turned and narrowed her eyes. I continued, "I've just been tasked to take the team to Groton, Connecticut, something about testing dry suits for SWIC." Polly's frown grew darker as T cried in the background. Looked like he was coming down with another ear infection, or maybe diarrhea. "No, wait, I got this," I said, then stepped into the kitchen, grabbed the phone, and called my sister, Mara Lee, 8 years my junior. She'd always been there for me when I needed her. She didn't hesitate, saying yes. She'd be happy to fly up from Georgia and help Polly with the move. Polly stood in the kitchen doorway, arms crossed under her chest. She wasn't amused. "You want me to believe that you're being forced to leave here and go play around with your team while I pack up this house, clean and clear quarters, and drive to Georgia? Is that it?" "Well, you know, when you put it that way," she wasn't taking this so well. You know, guys can tell about things like that. I held my hands palm up and gave her my best, "What can I say?" look. Her mouth bent further into a stoic frown, and she turned and stomped out of the kitchen. Hey, it was mostly true.
Just when we'd become comfortable at Fort Devens, orders came down for Tom to report to the IOAC course at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, the summer of 1974. Tom found that he'd need to be somewhere else for training during that week we were to leave for Georgia. The need for Tom to be other places now becoming questionable. Before I could ask him any questions, Marley, that's his sister, offered to fly up and make the 3-day trip to Georgia with me. With me, T, now 15 months, and Lance, our Newfoundland. T had been ill with a stomach virus and was, in general, miserable. He'd seen a doctor, but his crying wouldn't stop. Marley arrived, the Packards came, and we piled into our new civil boat swagon station wagon. Tom cheerfully waved us off as I backed out of the driveway and set out for a canine-friendly Holiday Inn in Allentown, Pennsylvania. There we planned a respite from the first leg of the journey. T's ailment would not let up. He was traveling in a porter crib in the back seat, half dozing from the moving vehicle's vibrations, crying off and on. Lance was stuffed in the rear. The car was packed to the hilt, much of it diapers and Pedicure that T was supposed to drink until he saw another doc. We arrived in Pennsylvania, hauled enough baggage into our room to get us through the night. Fed Lance his oversized bowl of kibble and attempted to get T settled. Then in the corner of my eye caught Lance as his woolly hulk heaved his dinner into a pile that was slowly oozing its way into the carpet under the bed. Scooping that up as best I could between some cheap white paper plates we brought for our packed supper that evening, I fought the stench that filled my nostrils. He finally slept, oh joy, as at least we'd survived one fun-packed day of this trip. At 2 a.m., he began crying endlessly. By then, I worried about appendicitis. Marley and I dressed and found our way to the local hospital's emergency room. Leaving Lance in the car, she and I rushed in, T in my arms. Then Lance began to howl, an eerie, mournful sound that echoed in ear-splitting waves across the asphalt parking lot. Frightening, I thought, when I looked down at the huge ebony head, dappled in the moonlight, terrified with uncertainty. He's not the only one, I thought to myself. Policeman walking the night beat came into the emergency room, unsympathetic to this unlawful disturbance of the peace, to locate the dog's owner. Marley and I began taking turns, going out to calm Lance. He never stopped howling, nor did he get a diagnosis, but the doctor did get me something to calm him. We could barely define dawn hovering just under the Pennsylvania horizon when we joined Lance at the car. Streetlights blinked off as we started back to the hotel, and there we packed and left for Charlotte, North Carolina, where Tom's and my old friends Bill and Mary Beth Brawley had invited us to stay for the night. The Brawleys had planned to celebrate our arrival with a small but elegant dinner party at their new brick home. As they ran out to the car to welcome us, it was clear from their bewildered expressions they were not expecting our bedraggled sleep-deprived crew. My mom's southern vernacular crept into my head at the moment. We must have looked like we were sent for it and couldn't come. You ever heard that before? They had met Lance only once before when Tom and I took him along for a visit. He'd made the occasion memorable. So we went out for dinner. He'd somehow retrieved a full round of cheese from the top of the refrigerator and down the whole thing. Making no excuses when we accused him of the crime, he hung his head sheepishly and burped loudly. Was that proudly? This particular evening at the Brawleys went no better. We ate in shifts. Between T and Lance, there was no respite for any of us that night. We made do. I never knew whether I slept or not. Marlene needed to be dropped off in Atlanta for a conference, so that's where we directed our attention the next day. Finding the Marriott downtown was easier than I anticipated. We deposited her at the door and I directed the car toward Interstate 75. Driving through the city, I floored the gas pedal and never let my foot up. If I'd gotten pulled, I'd have asked for an escort to my mom and daddy's house in Macon. Pulling up at the curb where I'd grown up, I left T and Lance in the car. I pushed open the unlocked screen door. Mama greeted me but stood aside as I headed directly for the tub, turned on the water, and went to get tea. Mama was catching on. As I plopped tea down into the warm water, he made splashes and giggled, unaware of all he'd put us through, the little darling. Now I now remembered Lance who'd been left in the car. He nuzzled me gratefully when he jumped down, stretched, and trotted into the backyard. Finally, we could relax. We stayed with Mom and Daddy until Tom was able to check in at Fort Benning, and somewhere during this time I realized I was pregnant. By then I'd almost forgiven Tom for the lascivious trip we'd made without him while he was having the time of his life testing dry suits in Groton, Connecticut.
After a few swims, we discovered that we had to wear quarter-inch neoprene mittens rather than five-fingered gloves. When the water hit our faces, it immediately froze. So for protection, we coated our faces with globs of Vaseline. This way, the ice freezing on our face didn't touch our skin. Of course, our eyebrows caked with ice. Even though we wore heavy woolen socks, the cold was so numbing that when we completed a couple of hours swimming with fins, we weren't able to stand, much less walk, for several minutes. Swimming under these severe conditions proved a challenge, to say the least. On our last 6.5 mile swim down the Thames River, it snowed. We swam in pairs. As usual, Brockman and I swam together. When we finally got to the LCM with our legs numb by the cold, the Navy guys had to carry us onto the ship's rear. The Navy chief in charge of the ship said, "This really sucks. You guys must be just plain crazy." And with a big grin scratched across his face, Brockman shot back, "Chief, you ain't gonna believe this, but this is the most fun I ever have with my clothes on." That Brockman.
Still, we were in the military, and time was nagging us to make the decision to stay in or get out. The trick was on me. My husband was living his dream. He was now employed in the daring sporting club of the Special Forces, snow skiing, scuba diving, parachuting, and mountain climbing. For him, the decision demanded little thought. For me, shaking up the system became my forte. As Tom's dependent wife, I challenged the term from the Bavarian Alps to the North Carolina Sandhills in my quest for one wife's independence.
Okay, that's the easy thing. When people read the memoir, they read all the stuff I've done, and they look, "Oh yeah, that must have been tough. I don't understand how Polly put up with all this." That's the common cry from them. Let's see, I'll read a few other excerpts before y'all get bored and start wanting to walk off. When I got to Vietnam, they sent me to an A site. It's the Special Forces A teams had these 12-man teams sitting out along, and mine was along the Cambodian border. And we would have with us a whole little community of CIDG, Civilian Irregular Defense Force, basically mercenaries that the Special Forces paid. They were Vietnamese, and we conducted interdiction operations along the Cambodian border. Life on the A site was very interesting. And let me give you a little preview here of what it was like when we went on the combat operation. We would rest overnight in tree squares. I would set up a poncho, blow up my air mattress, and hang my body mosquito net under the poncho and over the air mattress. Then I would dig a body trench about a foot deep. Of course, the trench filled with water, but should we receive incoming, I could roll over into it, find some protection. As daylight gave way to twilight, the ants left the scene to be replaced by mosquitoes. I've never seen anything like it. I could lie on my air mattress and watch outside and watch the outside of my mosquito net turn dark with the infuriating little insects blocking out the twilight. I would tap the net with my finger and a hole of light would appear, then close up again as the mosquitoes returned. Very uncomfortable. A Special Forces A team consists of basically 12 individuals, mostly NCOs, with different specialties like demolitions, weapons, operations intelligence, medical, and communications. So this is a little quick story about our medic. Doc Jungling, the senior medic on the team, was the most knowledgeable in his field and not only provided medical support for the team, but he also supervised Vietnamese medical personnel he had trained to take care of the CIDG and their families. The young wife of one of the CIDG were going to have a baby. It wasn't supposed to be a big deal, as Jungling and his trained Vietnamese medics delivered babies all the time. As luck would have it, the birth wasn't going well, as it should have, and we called a medevac. Several of us helped Jungling get the girl down to the helipad. It would rain, then clear up as a thunderhead passed over. As she screamed and jungling worked on her, I held the corner of a pacho that seemed to weigh 50 pounds. I closed my eyes as the blood drained from my head and my knees quivered. I prayed for her and I prayed that I wouldn't pass out. I'd never live that one down. It was a breech berth on a helipad in the rain under a poncho, and jungling pulled it off, or maybe I should say pulled it out, just as the chopper touched down. He and the new mother and her husband, who was holding the corner of the poncho and trying like me to stay conscious, got into the chopper and lifted off. The mother and baby would do just fine. It was then that I realized that there was just about nothing that an SF soldier couldn't and wouldn't do. So, and throughout the memoir, I have numerous occasions to point out some of the unique capabilities of these guys that are on the Special Forces A team. I spent the first part of my tour on the A site. Then we shut it down, turned it over to the Vietnamese Rangers, and I moved to a site called Long Hai, where we were training Cambodian soldiers. At the time, the Khmer Rouge was threatening to take over and eventually did Cambodia. Well, they would send the soldiers, the civilians, 12 years old to 64, into Vietnam where we were. We'd train them, run them on combat operations, then send them back to Cambodia. Here's a little bit of this. From December of 1970 to August of 71, I spent my time training Cambodian soldiers. We'd received plane loads of C-130s filled with trainees from 12 to 64 years old. I often think about those young boys who had to become men too soon. The Khmer Rouge, under the leadership of dictator Pol Pot, inflicted a nightmarish slaughter between 1975 and 1979, causing the death of at least 1.5 million Cambodians. This bloodbath surely cost most of the men and boys we trained their lives. We would take these guys and we'd put them through basic and advanced training, and then we'd go out on combat operations with them. And this is a little to give you an idea of what a helicopter pilot in Vietnam was able to do. I took off flying in a UH-1H chopper. Modified M-60s hung out each side, a double canopy jungle that stood thick before man walked upright and would stand thick long after he had taken his last step, rushed beneath us. After about an hour, we saw a wisp of purple smoke marking the LZ. The battalion had cleared for us. It was nothing more than a hole in the jungle, just large enough to get a chopper in. Maybe. We all made fun of helicopter pilots and their sacred crew rest, saying that it wasn't their flight pay we resented, it was their base pay. Anyway, the warrant officer, just a kid, driving his chopper, really had his stuff together. He pulled into a hover above the hole and started down. I couldn't believe it. The rotor blades were actually clipping leaves from trees as we sunk into the jungle. It went from being bright to gradually darker, then darker shades of gray the further down we sank. Finally, we touched down. I eased off the side and stepped onto the ground, deciding that I would rather walk out than take the chopper back up through that hole. The guy lifted off like it was a Sunday drive through the park, then disappeared. And I got a picture of this guy, and he looks like a teenager looking at the window there. Let's see.
Let you ask some questions.
Yeah, let me stop here and see if anybody has any questions about anything. No? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Yeah. Okay. What years were you in Nam?
I was in there in August of 70 to August of 71.
Okay. Down near the Bishop Harris Beak area?
Well, under the armpit of the Angel's Wing on the Cambodian border. Okay. Nixon had just, about 2-3 months before I got to the A site, they had just come back from that big push into Cambodia where they just cleaned house. I mean, it was unbelievable. The A site that I was going to usually got shelled every other night and probed quite often. Well, after that big push, nothing. The whole time I was on the site, we didn't receive one incoming round or didn't get probed. So I told Dad, I said, whatever you think about Nixon and whatever he did a great thing for me when he had that push into Cambodia. So, and things were pretty quiet for that, most of that tour there. You know, it was beginning to die down, and we finally left in 75.
I was a door gunner with the first of the cab, and we moved south near the Fishhook area. Mm-hmm. It was a Special Forces compound just this side of the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the Mekong River.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to fly into it quite a bit, but it, in 68 and 69, it was getting hit a lot.
Yeah.
Prior to the insurgents.
Right.
I didn't know if that was the same compound or not.
No. It was a different one. And when we talk about the Angel's Wing and the Fishhook and the Parrot's Beak, that's, if you look at a picture of South Vietnam and the Cambodian border, you can see it kind of looks, one looks like a Parrot's Beak and the other looks like a little Angel's Wing, and they had the fish hook. So that's what, when you hear Vietnam veterans talk about it, that's what they are doing.
I have a question for Polly. When Tom was in Vietnam, did you watch the news? Did you keep up? How did you keep up or not keep up with what was going on in the war?
Well, I saw the news. You know, I was in school, and the first quarter, I didn't have a television. I mean, I didn't have access to television where I was. I did for the other 2/3 of the year. Yeah, I listened, and I tried to avoid, you know, I avoided windows. I mean, I really did, because we all knew that they drove in these gray cars, and I was upstairs usually, and looking out, I shuddered every time I looked out of a window. Mm-hmm. But
I know that feeling.
Yeah, okay. But I tried not to think about it. Now, he wrote, every day he wrote. And the letters sounded like he was having fun. And I was really not having fun, so I presented that. You know, I mean, he was swimming, and he was sending me pictures of swimming in the, you know, jumping into, like, over the front of the book, you know, jumping into the bomb crater. But I just got by. we were lucky enough to get R&R that Christmas. He left in August, and we had R&R for Christmas, which was kind of interesting. I cover that in my, I think you covered
it. Yeah, I
did too. Did you go to Hawaii?
Yeah, we did. And that's interesting too, when they get there and they all look alike and you don't recognize them. You know, you just sort of have to wait for them to find you. It was, and then again, there you know that there's somebody whose husband's not going to be there, and you're waiting to see who it's going to be. I mean, you're waiting for the chaplain to come out and look for somebody. And so it's, you know, it's an odd year to live there. A lot of people did, though. A lot of you might have. But yes, we, you know, I survived it, and he came home, and we kept on going.
How many Vietnam vets do we have in here? Okay, and I have a question. How many have ever heard of the Santee Raid? That was a raid conducted in 1970 by Special Forces into the Santee prison camp. It was in North Vietnam to try to rescue prisoners. But when they got there, it turned out that they'd just moved about 2 or 3 weeks before that. I want to read one more thing real quick, because of the veterans in here from Vietnam are going to be kind of surprised at this. I was serving at the time as a J3 operations guy for the Special Operations Command in Korea. And I had an office in the U.S. side and also with the ROC Special Forces. And it was there where I spent most of my time, and that's where this took place. Major Bates, my plans officer, handed me several sheets of paper stapled together. You're not going to believe what I just found in the back drawer of my file cabinet. It's a briefing, no author noted, not even a classification. If it's true, this has to be top secret. I began flipping through the pages. The first page simply read, raid, then mission. Then the next page listed objectives, Hanoi City, Ho Lo Prison, Son Tay Prison, CSA Site 39, Laos, Haiphong Harbor. I continued flipping through the pages until I got to assets. Bates, standing beside me, stabbed the list of four named Americans with his finger that were credited to have confirmed information on prisoners. and identified 9 out of 13 prisoner of war camp locations. Stunned, I sat back in my chair. I recognized all four names, but one flew at me like a witch on a broom. If I were to believe what I was reading, which I did not, and it were to get out, it would cause a paradigm shift for all of us Vietnam veterans. That name was, you gotta buy the book.
I'll let the bribe not to say it.
Okay, well, thank y'all so much for coming.